Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. Today our show is exploring what it's like to be a young person in Appalachia these days.
It's a constant battle between, do I further my education or do I actually survive? Do I have food to eat? Can I have a place to sleep? Or am I going to go to class tomorrow? So it's a constant struggle of, you feel like you're never getting ahead here.
And we'll hear what Dolly Parton remembers from her time as a teenager in Eastern Tennessee.
Mama, she always understood stuff like that. If we wanted to do something, Mama just always said, you be what you are and you don't have to worry about nothing. If you want to say something, you say it to whoever. If you want to say something, just tell them. And I always did, and I still do.
The bright lights of the city are a pretty
sight. You'll find these stories and more this week. Inside Appalachia.
Well, I've been all around this great big world by bus, car, and train. I flew across the ocean in a big old jet airplane. And I have seen some fine things everywhere I've roamed. But there ain't quite nothing like my old West Virginia home.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. I loved growing up in southern West Virginia, where I call home. But I also know firsthand that it can be pretty tough to be a young person here. It sounds like young folks today are facing a lot of the same challenges. Not much to do and not a lot of job opportunities.
My generation is constantly scrambling around trying to figure out how to even survive here. It's not about thriving, it's about surviving when you're a young person in Appalachia.
I'm ashamed that people aren't as proud as I am to be here, and that people don't want to take care of one of the poorest regions in the United States.
But there's a lot of love for our region in the younger generation, too.
You find people here that will just welcome you in like family, whether you're related to them or not. And it's really hard to find that out in the world today, especially with, you know, technology and social media. It's hard to get people to really connect human to human.
So some younger people are making their own opportunities. Today we're going to talk with people in their teens and 20s who are creating art and music here, and we'll hear their ideas and hopes for what our region could be. Let's listen to someone who we all know, the one and only Dolly Parton. She's kind of one of the most celebrated stars of Appalachia. In this vintage interview with Dolly, you'll hear some of her memories of growing up in the Appalachian Mountains of Eastern Tennessee. This interview comes to us from the PBS series and podcast, Blank on Blank.
I'm David Gerlach. This week's episode features the one and only Dolly Parton. Parton was recorded back in 1978. She was being interviewed by Lawrence Grobel. This was for a profile that eventually ran in Playboy. Now, at the time, Dolly didn't know if she would end up on the cover of the magazine. She said she'd be up for wearing Playboy's iconic bunny costume if it did happen, but posing naked, that was not happening. Regardless, Dolly did end up on the cover, and that issue of Playboy turned out to be one of the biggest sellers in the magazine's history. Anyway, what caught our attention listening to this interview, to this tape, were Dolly's stories about growing up with 11 siblings in Tennessee. I mean, they're stories that only Dolly Parton could tell. Here's the tape, which has never been heard before.
I'm just pretty open and honest. I mean, there's not just a whole lot I won't tell you. That's, I think most people appreciate the fact that you'll just be open and honest rather than, you know, putting you down by saying, well, don't ask silly questions. Mm-hmm. I would say that if you asked something I thought was a silly question. I would just...
All right, here we go. When did you first use a flush toilet?
Don't ask silly questions. Are you serious? Well, you know, I was laughing the other night about something. I guess my aunt had a toilet and a bathroom, and we were so fascinated. You know, we were afraid. I was afraid to use it. You know, I mean, I just thought it was going to just suck us right down. It was just really weird. It was, she also had the first television we ever saw, too.
How old were you when you first saw television?
Maybe 8.
And the toilet around the same time?
Yeah, I guess it was just all new. So I was thinking about if I was on the Johnny Carson show. I just got to thinking one night I was laughing about how nobody had ever asked me about how we bathed or what we did, you know, because we didn't have, you know, we made our own soap. And in the summertime, we'd go to the river we just all piled in the truck or something. Of course, we had a creek, but the river was great. That was like a big bath. You know, and we would get all going swimming, and we'd wash each other's hair. And, you know, just soap was just flowing down the river. I mean, you know, that's where we bathed in the summertime. And I was making a joke about how there's so many of us, and we were so dirty that we left a ring around the little Pigeon River, you know, like a bathtub. In the wintertime, we just had a pan of water, and we'd wash down as far as possible, and we'd wash up as far as possible. And then when somebody cleared the room, we'd wash possible. So, I mean, that's the way it was.
How often did you bathe in the winter? Was it like once a week or every 2 weeks? Or?
Well, we bathed once a week whether we needed it or not. Yeah. That's the same goes. Well, when I was in high school, you know, it was a big deal. I had to take a bath every night, you know, so I wanted to be clean. Because kids peed on me every night, and we all slept. There were so many, many of us. But we slept, you know,
how
three and four
you?
In the bed. I would wash every night. And
as soon as I
go to bed, the kids would wet on me. I'd have to get up in the morning and do the same thing.
When they wet on you, though, did you get up and wipe yourself down? You just sort of accepted it?
That was the only warm thing we knew in the wintertime. I mean, that was almost a pleasure to get peed on. Because it was so cold, Lord. It was as cold in the room before we slept as it was outside. We'd bundle up to go to bed. So we wanted to wear lipstick and stuff, and Daddy didn't want us to wear lipstick. So we didn't have money to buy makeup anyway, but we used to have this medicine, you know, called methylate and mercuprime. And that's what I'd paint my lips, even as a little kid. I mean, I always wanted to wear makeup. And I'd paint my lips, and see, there wasn't nothing Daddy could do. He couldn't rub that off. You know, it stains your lips. And those little bitty bottles are just perfect to go around your lip line. And then I would blot it off, and then Daddy, he'd say, come here, and get that lipstick off you. And I'd say, it won't come off. You know, it's my natural color, Daddy. He'd say, bull. And we would always, when we wanted eyebrows, you know, we'd get burnt matches. The matches that had been burned. Mm. And you could wet them, and you know, you could make, you know, little eyebrows and whatever. When I was a sophomore in high school, I started, the tease hair came into style, and I started doing that, and ever since then, I've done it. I just like it, and I wore my skirts so tight I couldn't hardly wiggle in them, even as a little bitty kid. Even before I had a figure, I liked my clothes, you know, snug and tight. And people would always kid me in school about my little butt, you know, and my little blue jeans or whatever. Mama, she always understood stuff like that. If we wanted to do something, Mama just always said, you be what you are, and you don't have to worry about nothing. If you want to say something, you say it to whoever. If you want to say something, just tell them. And I always did, and I still do.
The bright lights of the city are a pretty sight to see.
Miss Dolly Parton. You have to see the cartoon Dolly Parton in our animated interview series with PBS Digital Studios. Watch it on our website, blankonblank.org. I want to thank Larry Grobel for bringing us this tape. Larry has interviewed Dolly numerous times over the last 30-plus years. You got to check out his amazing archive of celebrity interviews at lawrencegrobel.com. As always, the one and only Amy Drozdowska produced this episode with me. What else? We're up and running on Instagram now, so check us out. The handle is blank on blank. All right, that's it for now. Thanks for listening, everybody.
The goodnight kisses I get now are cruel and so demanding. So, Mama, when you pray tonight and while you're on your knees, Mama, say a special prayer.
Part of what I love about that interview with Dolly is how much it reminds me of stories from my grandmother and mother. Granny was never afraid to speak her mind and tell it like it is. Now, Dolly, she's always reminded me of my mom, who's also a blonde with a love for makeup and stands about 100 pounds soaking wet. Mom always encouraged me to move away and said the region was just too depressed for a strong spirit like mine. Mom told me to do better than she did and always insisted we go to college so I wouldn't have to depend on a man for anything, she'd say. She says nobody ever encouraged her to go to college. Now, obviously, many people who grew up poor in Appalachia, like Dolly Parton, have very fond and rich memories from their childhood. After all, living in poverty doesn't necessarily mean a person is unhappy. Still, one of the most difficult realities of poverty in Appalachia is that many people go without nutritious food to eat.
There are people here who don't even really, aren't really able even to buy their own food. And when you do buy your own food, it's not healthy options. You can't afford to actually take care of yourself. It's a constant battle between, do I further my education or do I actually survive? Do I have food to eat? Can I have a place to sleep? Or am I going to go to class tomorrow? So it's a constant struggle of, you feel like you're never getting ahead here.
That's Devin Creech. She's a 20-year-old from Eastern Kentucky. To help out families that have trouble getting enough food, some kids get free or reduced cost lunches at school. I know I did for a few years. But the summer break from school can be really tough for some of those families. Summer lunch programs across the country try to help feed those children, but lots of children still go without because they can't get to the school to eat. A program called Lunch Buses started up this summer in Jefferson County, West Virginia, bringing meals to children and seniors at designated locations. At the launch of the program back in June, West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Liz McCormick caught up with the Lunch Bus. The first day, things didn't go quite as planned.
Gigi, do you think you should call your people and tell them?
We're at North Jefferson Elementary School for the first day of the Lunch Bus. But where are the kids?
We're going to take it to them. We're going to go through the neighborhood.
That's Senator John Unger, a Democrat from Berkeley County, and the brains behind the Lunch Bus. Since no kids showed up, Unger decides to take the food to them.
You show me where to go. Okay.
We drive into a nearby neighborhood. Principal Mary Ann Jenkins of North Jefferson Elementary seems to know and remember each one of her students. Senator Unger urged a handful of students to come to the bus next time instead of having the bus come to them.
So tomorrow, we'll see you tomorrow over at the school.
The kids nod shyly. The Feed to Achieve Act, which is to improve academic performance by getting better nutrition, features its summer intergenerational food services program. Lunch buses are part of this initiative. The program is aimed to bring free meals to children 18 and younger during summer break, when those children might not get a steady meal since school is out. Any child can come get a lunch, no questions asked, and no signups are necessary. Seniors and adults are welcome to eat as well, but seniors are asked to donate at least $2 if they can, while adults are asked to pay $5. Senator Unger is also a pastor and says he was inspired to begin the Lunch Bus Initiative from the parable of the loaves and fishes.
So the concept of this is we are not just feeding children, but we're also developing community around that little boy, around that little girl. That with that, we have seniors and children eating together, doing activities together, along with volunteers, where if you ever put a senior and a child together, they both light up like Christmas trees.
All meals arrive on the Lunch Bus, but it doesn't just give out food. It also carries crates of library books for the kids to enjoy while they eat their lunch. The volunteers also have a number of other activities planned. Unger says this initiative is the first of its kind in West Virginia. On Fridays, lunch buses will offer backpack lunches to make sure the children have meals over the weekend. Meals are provided through donations from various organizations, such as the West Virginia Office of Child Nutrition, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and from a number of churches and nonprofits in the area. Lunch buses will run from June 16th through August 14th. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Liz McCormick in Shepherdstown.
Now we're going to join another summer lunch bus that launched this summer, this one in the coalfields of Eastern Kentucky. Renisa Harris is the head cook at A.B. Combs Elementary in Hazard, Kentucky. This year, her local school district has sent its summer lunch program on the road. Every weekday, Harris loads hundreds of meals into a bright van and delivers the food to low-income children throughout Perry County. Roxy Todd went along with Harris on one of her daily lunch routes to see the food truck in action.
It's midday at the community park in Hazard, Kentucky. Kids are splashing around in the pool. Others are waiting at the side of the parking lot. A truck comes down the road. It's shaped like an ice cream truck, except colorful illustrations of fruits and vegetables decorate the sides. Within minutes, Renisa Harris is leaning out of the food truck with a glowing smile, handing out lunch to four children.
Ooh, you get two bags. Got breakfast and lunch in them here.
Ooh, what do you say?
What do you want to drink, baby? You want milk? You want chocolate milk, white milk, or I have orange juice?
Juice.
Okay. David is getting lunch. His mother, Christy, says she's recently started bringing him here every day for lunch, along with three of her nephews and nieces.
We come over here and let them play and get some food, and it helps. I watch three different kids every day, so any little bit that'll help.
I have red apples.
I don't know.
David looks in his bag and finds the red apple he was hoping for. The program tries to include fresh produce in each meal. Schools here would like to buy more local vegetables and fruit to serve the kids, but the season doesn't really pick up for farmers here until the middle of the summer. They're hoping to purchase local watermelon and tomatoes to feed the children sometime in the next few weeks. Today, they're serving a hot dog, chips, grapes, apple, and an orange. Renisa Harris is the head cook at one of the local elementary schools in Hazard.
What do they call you?
Well, they know, some of them know me as the cook, so they know me as Renisa, but some of them don't. They just say, it's a food lady. One of the kids today was saying, you know, what the lady said, the little boy says, bite-bite truck. That's the bite-bite truck. He says, so when he sees us coming, he says, that's the bite-bite truck, you know, so that makes you feel good, you know. They know when you come here, they're going to get something to eat, something good.
Harris worked most of her life in the sewing industry until the local factory she worked at here closed down a few years ago. She loves her job now, working in the local schools, though there's one thing that never gets easy for her.
Anybody who has a heart know that, you know, when you work with the school system and you see the kids all year long and you worry, just you want to make sure that everybody's being fed. And so I worry, even on weekends I worry.
Summer lunch programs aren't anything new. They've been around since the late 60s. They're funded by the USDA, but at most of them, children go to a community center or school to eat. But one of the main struggles for Appalachian children is they live in more remote areas, usually without public transportation. So their parents have a more difficult time getting them to school so they can have their free meal. But in recent years, more and more summer meal programs across the country have been doing mobile meal programs. This year, Perry County Schools were able to purchase a truck so they could deliver those meals in neighborhoods and parks to children who otherwise might not have enough to eat. The truck delivers meals to at least 160 children a day. After the park, Renisa's next stop is a low-income housing development called Cherokee Hills. Renisa drives the truck across a misty four-lane road and along a hillside draped thick with kudzu. Actually, the food truck already made one stop at Cherokee Hills today, but Renisa said they were flooded with 75 children and ran out of lunches, so they went back to the school to restock.
And is it growing? Like,
it's growing every day. And then the more they spread the word, the more, you know, like I said, the more we get out and kind of drive around in back in the little culverts. Because some parents might not let you, they might be latchkey kids, and they might not let them, you know, come down to the one stop. So if we ride around through there and they see us, you know, they come out. So that's why I picked up some yesterday.
At the Cherokee Hills neighborhood, five kids run out of their apartments. Kayla Chandler's two children wave excitedly at Harris's van.
I love seeing the smile on their face when it pulls up. They wait for it every morning. There's just so many kids around here, you know, a lot of them that doesn't get fed like they need to be fed. And if it wasn't for the truck, they'd go hungry.
Marianne Feldner lives in a nearby apartment, and her grandson eats from the food truck every day.
They really enjoy it. They really do. That little young up here needs that. It's pitiful. And, you know, I thank God for that woman bringing that food. I really do.
Feldner is sitting in a living room decorated with dried flowers. Burgundy shades cast the room in a warm glow. Feldner has an oxygen tank to help her breathe. She's raising her 15-year-old grandson, Jared, who sits across from us on the couch.
Well, we get low on the end of the month, you know. I guess everybody does. We're on low income. And I really appreciate it, you know, what all they do for us. But every day gets a little harder for us, don't it? It really does.
Feldner says at first, she wasn't sure how she felt about letting her grandson take the free food. She says it was Harris's warm personality that made her feel comfortable with the idea.
She makes us feel welcome, you know.
Harris says she tells people like Feldner there's no shame in asking for help if it helps your child get the food they need.
And that's what I say. I mean, hey, I'm a parent. I know, you know, I raise kids. So, hey, I wish I knew this when mine was little. I'd been feeding them too. Get on that bus. Go eat. But there's no shame. That's my son. Yeah.
Hey, what's your name?
Brandon Willis.
Harris's son, Brandon, is now an adult and works as a sub cook at the school. This summer, he's working with his mother as she makes her deliveries to neighborhoods throughout Perry County. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd in Hazard.
Summer meal programs that deliver food to children like the ones we just heard about in Kentucky and in West Virginia are just starting to sprout up in other communities throughout Appalachia. The funding for the meals comes through the federal government, but local communities have to pay for the vehicles if they want to transport the meals. Most of these programs are looking for volunteers to help get food to children throughout the rest of the summer. Up next, we'll hear from a group of creative young Appalachians who are planning an event to celebrate what it means to be young in our region. I'm Jessica Lilly. This is Inside Appalachia.
A Union man for sure. He lived a hard and bitter life, but he endured. And Grandma was a lady, but she was tough as nails. She worked from dawn till dusk each day, till the light would fail. And the measure of a family isn't wealth or fame, but a heart that never wavers in a home where love remains.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Back in May, a group of politicians and White House officials traveled to Pikeville, Kentucky to hold a summit about Appalachia's future. It was part of an ongoing effort in Kentucky called SOAR, Shaping Our Appalachian Region, to talk about what's going to happen to Appalachia in the next coming years. But the group that stands to inherit this place, Appalachian Youth, were not among the speakers during this conference. To give themselves a chance to come together and be heard, a group of young people in Appalachia recently decided to throw their own conference called It's Good to Be Young in the Mountains. Organizers say the conference will feel more like a festival. It'll take place in Harlan, Kentucky in mid-August. To get the conversation started, we wanted to hear from some of the organizers and hear what they love and what they don't love about living in Appalachia. You've heard some of these voices already in our show today. Devin Creech is a 20-year-old Middlesbrough resident and Harlan County native. She's a graduate of the Media Institute from Appleshop that teaches young people to make films. Devin is also co-coordinator of It's Good to Be Young in the Mountains.
I think that Appalachia as a whole is a wonderful and beautiful place. It's the place that I call home. And to me, it's one of the only places left in America that is very, very deeply rooted in its own culture. I read online today an interview with John Haywood, and I think he said it best when he said we're some of the most intelligent people in the world because we don't have access to all of the things that everyone else has. We have to make do. We have to figure things out ourselves. We're very resourceful people. We have learned to adapt, and we will continue to adapt. And that's kind of the basis of my work, is to promote adaptation in Appalachia.
Like Devin, many young people here see the natural beauty and culture of Appalachia as a benefit to growing up here. Brandon Gent is 22 years old, and he says one of the first things he tells people when he meets them is that he's from Southeast Kentucky.
Appalachia's always been home, and this is where I feel like I've grown up, and this is where I feel like I've developed and become the young man that I am today. Being a young person here, I think it's distinct. It leaves a lot of room, leaves you to be open to a lot of different things, to be creative with how you spend your time. You know, just thinking about my cousins that still live up north, like they have access to things that are 5 minutes down the road, 2 minutes down the road. They can walk to things. You know, if they have to go to a gas station, it's right by their house. Whereas with me, it's like half a mile down the road. It's 10 minutes down the road. It's whatever down the road. You know, there are malls and there are movie theaters and there are things to do, and You know, here you have to kind of look a little harder for things to do.
Brandon is another one of the organizers of It's Good to Be Young in the Mountains, which will take place August 13th through the 16th. We'll pick back up with Brandon in just a few minutes and hear what he feels is keeping his generation from thriving in Appalachia. But first... So you probably know that one of the things that we love to do here on Inside Appalachia is explore the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. We call it What's in a Name? Sometimes towns get their names from animals, like a few we've already explored, like Bug Tussle, Kentucky, and Duck, West Virginia. So since today we heard from Dolly Parton, who was born in Tennessee, we wanted to feature a town from Dolly's home state. So can you guess what town in Tennessee got its name from a flying flock of geese? We'll have the answer after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia.
Ain't got no home and I ain't got nobody I can call my own. I'm satisfied, got nothing to do but long for a dime for that Red Mountain wine.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. So, think you know what town got its name for a flock of geese flying overhead? We called up Vonda Dixon, a genealogist at the Smith County Public Library in Carthage, Tennessee, to learn about how the town of Goosehorn got its name.
Yeah, I can tell you, Goosehorn, they could not decide on what to call it. A group of old men were sitting on the front porch, and they were discussing what they wanted their name to be, and a flock of geese flew over, and you know, had geese honk. So, hey, Goosehorn.
So that's the story about Goosehorn, Tennessee. If you have another story about Goosehorn or know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag What's in a Name, and we might explore it inside Appalachia. Music, art, local food, these are the things many young people crave if they're going to stay and flourish here. Although the economy is critical, it isn't all about jobs. We're going to pick back up with our earlier conversation with young people in eastern Kentucky. Let's hear what Devin Creech says she loves about living in the mountains.
I'm proud of this region because we have so much beauty here. Everywhere you go, it's like a show. Everything around you is big and beautiful and special. And the people here are unlike anyone I've ever met. I couldn't explain to you the feeling of having just the worst day and five different people waving at you as you drive through town. You don't get that anywhere else. One of the advantages, I think, to living here is that it makes people more interesting, because here you can't just go out and have something to do every single night. It's not like being in New York City or being in Los Angeles. It's not the same thing as that. It's sitting at home and thinking, okay, what can I do today? What thing can I do today? And thus we create this whole breed of Appalachian artists, these people who don't have parties to go to and shows to go to and festivals to go to. So they paint and they write and they play music. And that's a huge advantage from being here. I think that it's made me a very full person on that level.
Another member of the committee putting on the It's Good to Be Young event is Annie Zomaya. She's a 19-year-old Cumberland native and a student at Eastern Kentucky University.
I'm really proud of the culture here and the sense of community. And when you find people here that will just welcome you in like family, whether you're related to them or not. And it's really hard to find that out in the world today, especially with, you know, technology and social media. It's hard to get people to really connect human to human. And it's really easy to find that here, and it's just magical.
Although these young people are proud of this place, they also have some strong opinions about its issues. Again, here's Annie.
As far as what I'm ashamed of, I would say the lack of ambition that a lot of people have shown. that are from here, a lot of people feel limited because they're kind of brought up that way. For example, a lot of people in my family wanted me to go into the healthcare field just because it was the easiest way to find a job here. And that's not necessarily what I wanted to do. And I actually had the courage to say, you know what, that's not what I want to do. That's not what I'm going to do. I'll find my own way. But I think a lot of that is changing. And part of what Young in the Mountains is trying to do is encourage the younger generations to go beyond the norm.
Another problem young people say they face here is that they just don't have some of the resources people in big cities take for granted. Here's Devin Creech again.
One of the disadvantages is just being behind on so many things. I, for one, do not have internet availability where I live. And I talk about that all the time, but that's crazy. In the 21st century, I cannot get internet. It's not about costs. It's about the fact that there's no availability for me there. And that, in itself, puts me years behind the rest of the world. It is very, very hard to be a young person here for very different reasons. Number one, financially, it's almost impossible to support yourself here. I've been on my own for almost 3 years now, and the things you have to do without are really inconvenient. On top of that, the older generation doesn't really treat the youth as if they have much of a voice. We are kind of looked down upon here. We live in a place where there's a huge gap between generations. There are people from 25 and under, and then you've got 50 and up, because everyone in between is left. And there's this awful, horrible debt that we have been handed down by the older generation, in which we as a place economically have not a leg left to stand on. And thus, my generation is constantly scrambling around trying to figure out how to even survive here. It's not about thriving, it's about surviving when you're a young person in Appalachia, especially an independent young person in Appalachia.
There is a prescription drug problem.
This is Brandon Gent again.
There is a lot of poverty. There is such and such things. And I'm not ashamed that it's here. I'm ashamed of how it's dealt with. I think a lot of it has to do with neglect with the people here, has to do with the fact that there are big corporations and big companies and big politicians that are coming in here and draining us dry and leaving us without a dime, that are coming in here and don't care about the people. They care about the place and about the resources and the minerals and the things that they can get out of here. People that come to document us and try to get the best, most, and by best, I mean, I use that very loosely, but the wildest, craziest, outlandish story from person in Holler 17 that no one's ever talked to or heard of. I'm ashamed that people aren't as proud as I am to be here, and that people don't want to take care of one of the poorest regions in the United States, that people don't want to invest in their fellow countrymen and their fellow brothers and sisters that live in Appalachia. There are a lot of reasons why poverty happens. There's a lot of reasons why obesity happens, and there's a lot of reasons why people get on drugs and stuff like that. And it doesn't necessarily have to be all their fault. There's a lot of different narratives and a lot of different stories. But the way that it's dealt with and the way that it's handled and the way that we're treated is what I'm ashamed of.
You're told your whole life that growing up here in Eastern Kentucky means that you're never going to amount to anything. You're never going to have any opportunity. You're never going to be able to do the things that you might want to do with your life. And not only is that something that we as Appalachians do to ourselves, it's something that the rest of our country does to us as well. I hope that we teach our children to be proud of where they're from, not to be ashamed. I hope that we teach our children how to survive here. I mean, that's where our future lies.
Devin Creech and the other organizers of the festival say it can be hard to be young in the mountains, isolating and lonely at times, especially if the next big town or city or music festival is literally hours away. On the other hand, sometimes just being in a very rural place pushes people to be creative, to make their own art and invent their own gatherings. Here's Brandon Gent again, talking about how he and young people in Eastern Kentucky spend a lot of their free time making art and music.
I wrote a lot of short stories and poetry. I doodled a lot. I did. My sister's an artist, and my sister also plays drums and is really involved with music. I started trying to learn how to sing when I was in high school just because I had the time to do it. So you spend a lot of time thinking and drawing and writing and going outside and doing stuff like that. Culturally, there is a huge culture here for music and for art and for using time creatively. You know, Appalachian music in itself is very distinct, and it comes from just here, and it has a unique sound, and it's something that's passed down from family member to family member. There's an advantage to living a little bit more simply, to living a little more calmly, slowly. But as far as being young, I think it's just as cool to be here and be young as it is anywhere else.
Thanks to Destiny Caldwell of WMMT for sharing the interviews with Devin, Brandon, and Annie. For more information about the It's Good to Be Young in the Mountains conference in August, head to our website at wvpublic.org. And even if you're not young, that is in your teens, 20s, or 30s, the conference is open to all ages of people who want to support young people throughout Appalachia. Over in Elkins, West Virginia, it was an old-timer who helped young folks make their own fun with music. The musical string band called the Elm Street Alley Cats of Elkins lost their mentor and bass player Gene Boyer in 2013. Since then, the group's been working to make the old tunes he taught them better. They've also been learning newer, contemporary music of their own.
Teenagers Nevada and Riley Tribble and Walter King have been going to shows at the Augusta Heritage Center for years. In 2010, they formed a band called the Elm Street Alley Cats. One of their mentors, Jerry Milnes, says the three are among the youngest musicians to ever take classes at Augusta. And although they mostly play traditional old-time tunes, the Alley Cats also cover a few contemporary songs, like this one by the Avett Brothers.
I would be sad because you left me all alone. I would be sad for all the lies that you had told. I would be sad because I got left by a girl that I adore. I would be sad for all the lies.
The Alley Cats began playing this song shortly before their fourth bandmate, Gene Boyer, passed away last May. He was 70 years old. The Tribbles' house stands out from the street because of the solar panels on the roof, and because even from outside, you can hear the sound of 16-year-old Walter King warming up his fiddle. Beside him stands Nevada Tribble, with long, straight red hair and her banjo resting upright on the couch. She's about to turn 17 and is the Alley Cats' oldest musician. Her 14-year-old brother, Riley Tribble, plays the mandolin and upright bass. His bass is golden yellow and, as Riley explains, has a special significance for the Alley Cats.
Yeah, Gene lived just across the alley, and he originally played the bass. And I actually play his bass right now because, I got it after he passed away. I picked up the bass and started playing after an Augusta class. He played with us the first day that we played. It was like in the winter, and we went in our garage back there. So,
and we just decided to like play a tune together to see if it would work, and it was fun, so we decided to make a band. Gene got us our first gig at the Pickens Maple Syrup Festival, and we just drove up there and played for an hour.
The three young musicians learned to play music by ear, mostly by soaking up the vibrant music scene that hovers around Elkins during the summer for the Augusta Heritage Center, when there's music almost every night of the week. Many of the musicians the Alley Cats have learned from play at each other's houses or at square dances in Elkins. There's Greta Fitzgibbon, who taught Nevada her first banjo tunes, and Andy Fitzgibbon and Jesse Milnes, who have been teaching Walter fiddle.
Riley learned mandolin from Jeremy Wanless and Carl Smakula, whose father, Bob Smakula, sells string instruments. Nevada says she remembers the day she went to his shop to buy her current banjo.
It was really exciting, actually. It was one of the best days ever, because I went and it was like in Harry Potter where he goes and picks out his wand. That's what it felt like, because I went and like tried out a whole bunch of different banjos, and I picked out mine.
The fiddle I have now, I got it from Bob Smakula during the Augusta Festival when he sets up his tent in the park. He brings out all of his instruments, and I sat there for probably at least two hours just playing through probably 20 or 30 different fiddles.
Although they were neighbors, the middle school band was probably where Walter and Nevada became friends. They each played the flute, and later Riley played the trumpet. The three of them also learned to arrange music and experiment with contemporary songs from a workshop they do each year at the Randolph County Arts Center called Lab Band, which is nothing like the traditional middle or high school band.
Middle school band is everybody learns instruments, and you don't get, I mean, you couldn't just take a banjo to the middle school band. You have to, there's like, just, you can just pick from the ones that that are there, like flute, trumpet, the normal, like orchestra instruments, and then you get sheet music and you learn to read it and you play it, and that's all. In like lab band, or how we've made up our own band, we just like have, we can do like whatever we want. Lab band has been interesting because we play music with other teenagers, and it's really fun because we get to play stuff that's totally different from the normal things we play. So we've learned like Beatles songs and all kinds of like weird things, like pirate metal.
It's like electric guitars and such and loud. And Gogo Bordello is the band. And we transformed it into like our acoustic instruments and electric instruments combined, and horns and different I don't know, types of instruments, and made it the sound very similar, actually.
Last year, the Elm Street Alley Cats were invited to play in Washington, D.C. at the Hart Senate Office Building. It was just a month after their bandmate and mentor, Gene Boyer, passed away. Jerry Milne stepped in and played with them in D.C., and he's been helping the Alley Cats learn old-time tunes and help them figure out how to cover contemporary songs.
He comes to our practices sometimes and helps us work on new tunes or teaches us lyrics to old-time tunes. Jerry knows a ton about old-time music, so it's really awesome to have him helping us. I would hope that we'll start writing our own music and more. Walt's already written a song, but I hope that we can start exploring that more, writing our own music instead of just doing old-time tunes and covers of other bands.
For Allegheny Mountain Radio and Traveling 219, I'm Roxy Dodd.
Next, let's switch gears a bit from Alley Cats to orchestra. This next young West Virginia composer's work was recently featured on NPR's Performance Today. We here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting are very proud of Matt Jackford, our in-house composer. Back in 2012, he composed a symphonic work titled Vandalia. This performance by the West Virginia Youth Symphony Orchestra was recorded at the State Opera House in Banská Bystrica, Slovakia, which is the sister city of Charleston, West Virginia. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Beth Voorhees sat down with Matt recently to talk about his work.
In 2011, I believe, Bob Tiriziani, conductor of the West Virginia Youth Symphony Orchestra, asked me to write a piece that they could take on their 2012 tour of Europe.
Thank you.
something with some West Virginia flavor to it. So I actually ended up writing this piece first and didn't really have a title to it. And, you know, and then eventually Vandalia really stuck out to me because it was actually one of the proposed names of the state of West Virginia.
Where do you see your career going? I mean, you're being featured on Performance Today. Where does it go from there?
I don't know. I'm just going to keep writing, and whoever asks music of me, I'll just keep writing for it. You know, if it's more radio shows here, that's great. And, you know, documentaries like J.A. Rockefeller's Life, that was great. And The First 1,000 Days were both great documentaries. You know, I could definitely see myself doing more film. I could also see myself doing video games, too. I've done a couple now and would certainly enjoy doing more. So, you know, it's wherever the work leads me, and that's just, I think I just kind of follow that path.
Matt Jackford's piece, Vandalia, was featured on Performance Today last week. You can hear the entire composition on our website, wvpublic.org. In keeping with our theme of being young in Appalachia, we end our show with a story about a series of music events that welcome kids, families, and people of all ages. It's held in the mountains outside Morgantown, West Virginia. Jesse Wright with West Virginia Public Broadcasting takes us to the Chestnut Ridge venue where the Hillbilly Gypsies were playing on a recent Saturday night.
We're going to try an original song here. This is one I wrote a couple of seasons ago on the way back from a show we played up around Ithaca, New York. On the way back, I almost fell asleep driving home. And Jamie said, "I'm good to drive if you want me to drive." And I said, "No, I'll be fine once I see the West Virginia line." And that rhyme got me thinking I could write a song out of that. And I wasted the next hour and a half on that rhyme and never even used it in the song. So this is called West Virginia Line.
Telling stories and interacting with the crowd are what Hillbilly Gypsies frontman Trey Buckner appreciates most about the Mountain Music Concert Series at Chestnut Ridge Park. The five-piece band from Fairmont have played their brand of foot-stomping bluegrass at Chestnut Ridge almost every summer since the series began in 2004. The stage that hosts the series band sits at the bottom of an old sledding hill surrounded by tall trees, giving it the acoustic feeling of an amphitheater.
Oh, it's excellent.
That's Fred Crozier. He's the mandolin player with Halftime String Band, a three-piece acoustic group from Morgantown. Crozier says Chestnut Ridge Park is one of his favorite venues.
The sound is really good because it's kind of a bowl with the trees here, and there's a flat area down in front for dancing, and children large and small out there dancing during the shows. So it's really fun to play here and watch the crowd.
Chestnut Ridge Park and Campground is off Interstate 68, 10 miles east of Morgantown. The park is nestled up in the mountains between Cooper's Rock State Forest and the West Virginia University Research Forest, giving it an advantage over other venues during the summer.
It's always a few degrees cooler here than it is down at the bottom of the hill at Cheat Lake. It's always about 5 degrees difference.
Steve Berry and his wife Karen have been coming to the shows at Chestnut Ridge for the past 5 years. I found them among the crowd on the slope waiting for Halftime String Band to begin their show. The sledding hill is perched above a playground and pond where a lifeguard watches over the kids splashing around in the cool water. People often bring coolers and blankets to the show so they can eat dinner while enjoying the music as the sun slowly sets. Dogs are allowed as long as they're on a leash, and the hill provides a place where kids can roll around, dance, and play. Crozier says that family-focused atmosphere keeps the bands coming back year after year.
It's a great venue for all of the local bands to come and play, and there's been a more diverse lineup of bands over the years.
The concert series mainly draws on musicians from the Appalachian region who play bluegrass, newgrass, and Americana, like Romney-based Lonesome Highway. An early summer storm drenched the campground and forced Lonesome Highway to play their June show indoors this year. But for the crowd, a summer storm doesn't necessarily mean the show is over.
It's rained in.
That's a good way of looking at
it. When the weather is bad enough to keep people indoors, the park has a rain venue, the campground dining hall. The dining hall has an open layout with benches and picnic tables, but there's plenty of room for dancing, too. The wood floors and paneling seem to lend a richness to the sound that the outdoor space doesn't. Banjo player John Arnold is one of Lonesome Highway's founding members. He says he doesn't mind to play indoors.
We've been together for 19 years as a band and played music for 30 years, so we found that when rain happens or some event happens that changes where you have to do it, sometimes it's better than, you know, I love inside like this, a little more intimate, and, you know, you can kind of get involved with the crowd a little more.
The Hillbilly Gypsies' Trey Buckner says if they're outside when a storm hits, sometimes they'll keep playing anyway.
Surprisingly, we've had a few shows where, you know, a major storm front would come through. And, you know, some of the crowd would leave, but we just turned off the sound system and everybody huddled around the stage. And, you know, that really made a nice, intimate, fun, for fun. The rest of the night was all acoustic, but it sure was fun to have everybody kind of huddled up around the stage. And, you know, they still danced and had a good time. The weather doesn't seem to drive anybody away.
Eleven years into the Mountain Music Concert Series, musicians like Buckner say that atmosphere, rain or shine, is what keeps it going strong. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jesse Wright in Morgantown.
Chestnut Ridge Park is planning a bluegrass festival as their final send-off of the year. Held on August 29th, it will feature groups like Halftime String Band, Circa Blue, Logantown, and others. For more information about the festival and tickets, and for more information about the It's Good to Be Young in the Mountains conference in August, head to our website, wvpublic.org. That's our show. You can head over to Twitter and let us know what you think. Is it good to be young in Appalachia? What are your main worries for folks today who are young adults? Hey, and let us know where your favorite music venue is. Summer's almost over, and we want to hear how you plan to spend the next few weeks. Our Twitter handle is InAppalachia. I'm at Jessica Y. Lilly. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WMMT and Blank on Blank. Music in today's show was also provided by Dolly Parton, Matt Jackford, the Hillbilly Gypsies, the Elm Street Alley Cats, Ben Townsend, and Dave Bing as heard on Mountain Stage. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our intern is Jade Arthur Holtz. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org, find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.